Elements podcast. We're the K. I'm Christian Corley, and with me are James McLean and Gareth Cavanagh.
I know. Two weeks running. People will talk.
If they're not already. And we're here to discuss the latest Doctor Who episode, It Takes You Away. Now, over the past few weeks, I've been attempting to do a kind of brief summary of these episodes. And I struggle with the most simple concepts of compressing those into like a 30-second summary. This week, I'm not going to bother.
Yeah.
Because there's something about this story which feels very difficult to shrink into a brief 30-second max description without it sounding like I've taken drugs.
How about Vikings, Stranger Things, Aha, Take on Me?
If you like.
That's pretty good.
But I don't think you've got it. I think, yeah, Stranger Things, but that ending doesn't fit into any of them.
Well, I mean, you're meant to... I mean, the whole point of doing a sort of brief synopsis of something for a podcast is you don't give away the ending. that's the way it rolls, Gareth.
No, what I'm trying to say, I think that those are the influences, but I don't think that's what that show is. Mm. I think it's something else.
So just if you're listening to this in 10 years' time, why would you be? Although, having said that, looking at the figures of some of our older podcasts, you might be. I don't know. So just to remind you, this is the episode in which the Doctor and Graham and the other two get to Norway, a fjord, visit a house. There's a little girl in there who's blind, and then they fall through a mirror, and Kevin Eldon's wearing some sort of like Star Trek Next Generation makeup, and then they end up meeting a frog.
Oh, that was Kevin Eldon.
Yeah.
This shows how much I'm paying attention to the blue.
Oh, I noticed at the end. I didn't realise watching who it was. I was trying to see who it was, which is really annoying that I didn't guess, because my son's been kind of box-setting Danger Mouse for the past fortnight.
Oh, old one or new one?
New ones. And Kevin Eldon's Penfold. So it's I was quite surprised I didn't catch on. So yeah, so that's this episode. And there's, do you know what?
Let's be honest. In 10 years' time, it's going to be the one with the frog.
It probably is going to be the one with the frog. But I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
I mean, does anyone want to guess how I enjoyed this episode or otherwise?
I'm going to guess you enjoyed it.
James, what do you think?
I'm going to guess you quite enjoyed it, but the Sheffield accent.
You've been on Twitter, haven't you?
Maybe.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. And I'm going to downscore it. When we get to the scores at the end, I'm going to downscore it by a full mark because of Sharon D. Clarke's bloody awful Sheffield accent.
Oh, Jimmy Hill lives.
It really is bad. But I love this episode. This is, I think it's probably the episode I've enjoyed the most this season. I like the creepy vibe. I like the mirror world thing. I like that. There's a feeling of like old school Doctor Who about this, like proper like 1970s Doctor Who. Then culminating with a Graham Williams era bonkers thing at the end in the frog.
Yeah.
God. Both sound like a pair of perverts.
We've been waiting 40 years for this shtick. What are you on about? That'll be a moment of purring Bond villain pleasure.
I can feel the electricity, the static friction that's been built up by the two of you profoundly rubbing your knees. Oh.
Yeah, no, I was gripped from start to finish, and I love the twist about the father trapping his daughter. And that was just, I was, I mean, that was, it was horrible. Don't get me wrong, but it was.
I didn't see that coming.
I mean, there was a feel that maybe there was not a monster outside, but what it was, I just didn't get at all. So yeah, I liked that, and the girl was good as well.
It wrong-footed me because, as you know, I work on Sundays, but you can't avoid social media, and you know, things started pinging in about 8:30. Oh bloody hell, that bloody frog. Oh, that frog. Oh, God, the frog. Then the Gabriel the Toad memes start turning up, and on it goes. And I thought, oh, God, there's a frog in it. Okay. right? There's a frog. So I started watching it, and then there's all these noises and monsters. And I thought, oh, right, okay, are we in for an invasion of frogs then from the forest? Is it going to be one great big huge frog that talks? And then someone was saying, oh, yeah, and the frog talks. I thought, oh, Christ, you know, is it going to be like a Brian Blessed cameo where he's like the king of the frogs and blah, blah, blah? So I went into it with quite low expectations, I'll be frank. And the fact we didn't get a Brian Blessed king of the frogs and an invasion of the frogs.
This is all sounding quite interesting.
Say again.
I'm just saying, a Brian Blessed invasion of the frogs actually sounds quite interesting.
Well, no, I enjoyed it, as you may have guessed. But what I enjoyed particularly, you know, and I said this with your synopsis, is it successfully wrong-footed me about eight times, in that it pretends, you think, okay, it's going to be sort of creepy house in the woods, Norwegian style. There's going to be some kind of folky shtick in there, and it kind of takes you down that route. Then the mirror, okay, that I didn't expect that at all. Then you go, okay, Stranger Things, interesting. You know, little creepy golem style guy, and you think, okay, interesting. And where we then end up with beautiful facsimiles of, you know, people that you love, and then, you know, the idea of into your universe, and then a frog on a chair, which I have to say took the cake and the biscuits. I just, every time, I couldn't say I saw anything coming, and no Brian Blessed as king of the frogs. So it was all good.
Yeah, so James, you've been quite quiet on this episode. I can't imagine you hated it.
I hated it. You reckon I did hate it? I was liking it until you mentioned the sort of Graham Williams element to it, and then obviously being your yin to my yang, or the oil to the water.
That position then, yeah.
I really liked it.
Being frogs and tachyonics, you've been grand.
Well, the frogs reminded me of my favourite era with the Fort of Doomsday. So
okay.
Yeah. No, I really liked it. I thought it was good. I thought it was, I think it was probably one of the best of the season. I had no issues with the Sheffield accent in the same way. Well, I didn't know, obviously, I don't have that sort of experience, but...
Well, you shouldn't have any issues with the Sheffield accent because there wasn't one.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we all know this is, you know, Perry, Jamie allegedly swapping accents. Well, not allegedly, but obviously swapping dialects. You know, Doctor Who's filled with painful accents occasionally. So I'm just lucky it didn't affect me, because I don't know what it should have been. If I did know, it probably would have bugged me as much as it's bugged you.
Well, it's really easy, the Sheffield accent, you see, because the Sheffield accent is not, "By heck, up and I'm from Yorkshire, like." It's not that. You know, like, people of that character's age and older... we'll end almost every sentence with duck.
But maybe this is one that doesn't. Maybe this Sheffield has...
But the rest of the accent's wrong as well, so, you know.
Duck? Bloody hell, that's what they say in Stoke.
Well, there you go, see? She hasn't even found a decent northern accent. She's just gone for cod northern accent.
Well, I thought she sounded like she was more from Leeds, to be honest. Like Vera Duckworth.
Maybe a little, maybe, but yeah, there's bits in there that just don't work for me at all.
Yeah, but quite frankly, you all sound like your Vera Duckworth.
Yeah,
right. to me. Appen. I mean, I'm not a language racist, but, you know, I don't know.
That's because that doesn't exist.
Very true. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, but he has a point. You know, I've lived in Manchester now for 25 years, and I don't have a Manchester accent. And if I turned up in my own version of Doctor Who, and then Christian Corley said, "Oh yeah, we didn't like Gareth Cavanagh. He had a terrible Manchester accent." Oh, oof! I'm marking that down 2 points in my final summing up.
1 point, Gareth.
Yeah, I would say so, you know, we don't even know if she is from. You know, she might only been living in Sheffield for 20 years. She might, you know, might be from somewhere else. She might have very strong Leeds roots that she's hanging on to. She might not know how to do a Sheffield accent. I don't know. But it sort of didn't make me think, oh, that were crap.
No, it doesn't make me think that, but it does. That accent takes me out of it. And then when the same voice appears on the frog, and I love the frog, but when the voice then appears on the frog, you got this frog with this weird accent that is completely unidentifiable. And maybe that works on the frog, but it doesn't so much work on the grandma.
But it creates an extra level of humour, though, because it means that yeah. that bad accent is the one thing that got left transferred over to a brand new creative universe. And the one thing it extrapolated from our universe is that really bad accent. Now, I think that's pretty interesting.
Well, you do realise that there's a delicious redubbing to be done on this. You know, you could almost choose your own frog accent.
Yeah. Brian Blessed is obviously the one that we'd be pumping for.
We would be entirely good, Brian. You know, although I think there's a, you know, I think there's a twee little Frenchman in there. Because, oh, no.
Well, after the weekend they've had in Paris, I think a little French voice in that frog would be very appropriate.
We have the answer. It's Alan Cummings.
Yes.
Really, Alan Cummings. As if he could choose any voice in the entire world, it's clearly James the First, Alan Cummings.
But that, I mean, yeah, the accent doesn't bother me because in my head, I think like you. I mean, I was born in Manchester as well, and I've lived various places. My accent is a mess. And while I'm not arguing at all that it's probably an actress doing a bad accent, which it clearly sounds like it is, that's the way my head would get around it if I had to endure it because I was so familiar with it, like Christian. But yeah, I thought it was really good. There were times in it where I was thinking, like you were saying, Gareth, I didn't know where it was going to go, and I was doubting where it was going to go. Like when we started to look through the mirror, I was thinking, yeah, this is Stranger Things. And to be honest, what was getting me with that wasn't the fact it was going to look like it was going to sort of mirror Stranger Things to avoid the pun, well, to use the pun. It was more the fact I was dreading seeing what people would say on Twitter, as if that would just give a reason for an excited hatred of the show because it was now copying Stranger Things. There was that sort of fear that was running through me. And then when at the end, when we see the grandmother again, there's part of me which is like, oh, you know, is this going to be like a Stephen Moffat thing where now she's going to be okay and she's going to go back and the last episode will be set in Sheffield and we'll deal with this? You know what I mean? I felt like it was one of these cheap revival things, which Doctor Who's done quite a lot of in the last 8 years. So there was times where I really doubted it. And I think what I liked about the story so much was first off, it never really fed into those doubts. It sort of moved on. It wasn't Stranger Things. It was quite fun in that sort of intermediate place. Kevin Eldon was great. The Mirror Universe at first seems a bit twee and a bit silly, but then it's got this whole thing about this. First of all, you think this is a really badly written dad, because again, I had little faith in it again. I was thinking, my God, you know, this dad, really? Would he actually just spend all his time over here with a fake wife, forgetting his daughter? And then you sort of really realize, oh my God, this guy actually is, he's got mental health issues here and it's acknowledged and he's a real mess. So maybe he would. And then you get that lovely bit at the end with this antagonistic universe, which is really beautiful and quite sad. Mm-hmm. And using the frog as well. And that worked for me as well. So just all the way through, it did something I wasn't expecting. And
yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's you know, it's exactly how you would do Omega now.
Well, maybe it was.
It is exactly how you would do Omega. Instead of this big ranty figure, you'd have it as this slightly sad, really lonely, you know, desperate for company, which has always been kind of there. But it was beautiful. Yeah. And, you know, I thought everything about that was lovely. And I'm very happy with it being a frog. You know, I suppose, you know... It had to be something, I guess. I mean, it could have been a teddy bear, I suppose. It could have been... I saw a lot of people on Facebook saying, oh, it should have been Susan. And I thought, oh, no.
No.
Because I point out this doctor, she doesn't have favourites, and there's not one particular person who's her, totemic force in her life.
You totally undermine the scene, because the scene is quite beautiful, because it's two strangers... sort of half against each other, half connecting with each other, and then there's this sort of love that sort of sits there. If it was Susan, you'd have so many other thoughts and ideas and things going that would just it wouldn't be about the frog anymore. It'd be the fact it was Susan, and you'd totally undermine what the whole scene was doing.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. So yeah, I'm very happy with it. I like the frog. I like the concept. Yeah, I thought it was lovely. And like I say, it's funny because it was exactly what I wasn't expecting all the way through.
Yeah.
Because by then I'd almost forgotten that there was supposed to be a frog. Because it opened with, oh God, here we go, Norwegian invasion of frogs, you know, and someone's put something in a fjord and all the frogs have gone mad. And I didn't get that. So, and like I say, every time I thought I knew where this was going, it went somewhere else. Up to and including Kevin Eldon, who is really just there to show that the flesh moths are a bit nasty. And mentioned the word interzone. And in fact, the flesh moths are really just there to give us a little bit of peril. But it works and it's all lovely.
It felt a bit like what I think Doctor Who should be, in the sense it felt eclectic, it felt weird, and it felt like it was just sort of breaking those, like you say, those rules. The moths and the sort of interspace area was really largely unnecessary, apart from creating a bit of tension. It didn't really feed the story, but it didn't need to. It was very fragmented, but clever and well balanced. And I don't know, it just felt fresh and not like really what we've had in the show before. So I thought it used the characters all very well, most of them well. I think Yaz didn't get much to do this episode, but I think by and large, I thought it was a good ensemble group.
Everyone kind of.
I do have a genuine misgiving, and that is the info dump.
Oh, where Granny number six says, "Oh well, you know, it's to this."
Yeah, that whole sequence. Yeah, it really it felt like it was taking a lot of time to say something reasonably simple that they could have just moved on to, rather. A bit quicker, I felt.
It's a strength and a weakness of the 60 minutes. I mean, there's so much crammed into that 60 minutes. I haven't felt something so conceptually dynamic and concise and clever since probably like Heaven Sent or The Doctor's Wife. It felt like it sits with those two in that. It's such a conceptual roller coaster that you don't necessarily sit back and think, oh, okay, that was a bit compressed and that was a bit info dumpy. But I'd say it gets away with it. I guess in a previous era, the showrunner would have given in to the temptation to have made it Omega and rung up Bob Baker and dropped him round a modest sack of loot, and then it would have been Omega. And I think
if it was Omega, and a lonely Omega, what's a lonely Omega gonna want? Doctor, I want someone to play crossword with.
Well, he wants someone to narrate his memoirs to, and I did this, and then I told Rassilon that, and what we've done for the last 80 million billion years. Well, I've, you know, it's been.
And do you know I've never heard from him since?
Exactly.
And then I turned round and they were all wearing eye patches.
Said that, if by now he's been in there that long, I could imagine that he's really not asked enough to create anything more than a white void and a chair. And actually he's trying out being a frog for the next million years, because he might as well be.
I'll tell you what, I did like that Norwegian hut, which I'm assuming was in Wales somewhere.
Yeah, gotta be.
Well, regardless, I loved the way that the interior of the loft space was mirrored in the solid tract world. You know, that triangle thing, is that triangular thing. It was very nice. I like that.
Yeah, it was good. Oh, I tell you what, we can't let Bradley Walsh go unmentioned for great plaudits, you know.
Oh, definitely not, no.
He showed he was up to the job. And you know, handled that, all those emotional scenes without going over the top, with maturity. It was really beautiful. I think he's the only actor in that entire cast that could do that, I think. Up to and including Jodie Whittaker, where I think there's still a little bit missing from her repertoire. I think we're only seeing 2/3 of what her Doctor is, you know, with the sort of the surprise, the delight, you know. But a bit like McCoy, she doesn't do anger and panic very well. I think she's got to find that yet in her toolkit.
Yeah, I think that's difficult to argue with. I'm still wanting to see more from her, and I do find myself disappointed week week on week. But I think there's, yeah, this episode is a very strong episode. I've just been checking the broadcast reception. There's a big one, the reviews that have been collated so far for this episode on Wikipedia. Right. Daily Mirror gave it 3 out of 5, Metro 3.5 out of 5, Telegraph 4 out of 5, Independent 5 out of 5, Radio Times 1 out of 5.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I knew that the broadsheet seems to have enjoyed it more than the tabs. That's fair.
Yeah.
And Radio Times, presumably they just hate the Talking Frog.
I'm not read it, so it's difficult to say. But I think there's been a few bad reviews from Radio Times so far this season. I don't think that's the first bad review. I don't know if the others have been quite as low as that.
That's 1 out of 5.
Oh, here we go. Against the odds, Jodie Whittaker excels in her final exchange with the frog, alone in a white space, acting in reality with nothing. It's like an audition piece. But it goes on. It takes away. It's a disappointing excursion and mostly plays like some generic dreck you'd stumble upon. And then it wants me to watch a video to read the rest of the article. No, thanks.
Who is this arse?
That's Patrick Mulkern, long-term Radio Times Dot 2 reviewer, yeah.
Patrick. Well, but he's being an arse.
But this is the problem with where you have these sort of online magazines, which essentially when the newspapers and things like Radio Times do these sort of things, they're sort of adopting the magazine sort of style with these reviews. Is that they seem to be sort of bringing in, like Digital Spiders, the same sort of Doctor Who fans or people with an interest in the show to reflect on the show, which is great in a sense, but it also means they carry those same sort of the baggage that can appear when you have something which you feel very strongly for that goes in a different direction than you like. And I don't know if it makes you entirely objective. I think if I was doing stuff for Moffat, maybe I wouldn't have been very objective either, because it was the things he was doing which just wasn't chiming with me, but would chime with other people.
Can we between us think of a single one-star story in the run since 2005?
Yes.
Go on.
I've forgotten what it was called.
Describe it.
It was this season.
A one star this season? Wow.
Yeah, I gave...
The scene.
So, James?
Was it the one with the little bastard on the ship?
Yes. Yes, that one, yes. Oh, God, yes.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. Okay.
I didn't mind that. It didn't bother me as
well. Yeah, it's not very good. It's not the only one, though.
Is the writer has basically wiped his bum on the script and posted it through your letterbox. what one star is. And I don't
know. Well,
I
think we were voting out of 10, weren't we? So it wasn't really one star. Because I said it was 2 out of 10, didn't I? So that would be a one out of five.
One is beyond redemption. It's indescribably poor in execution, in concept. And actually, there's something actually really badly wrong with a one star. You know, it's an insult. It's an Ian Levine with a hammer through your telly.
yes.
Hi, Ian.
You know, and there aren't many of those in Doctor Who's history. I really can't think of one in the new series that's moved me to that level of either indifference or fury. There's been
how are you with the eye gunk monster, Sleep No More?
I actually love that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, even now, I mean, I hated it largely, but I can't say that the ending wasn't quite innovative. So
the ending is brave.
I don't know if I could give it one star. I'm sure there's ones where I felt really annoyed and frustrated. But again, this comes down to the fact that is it the whole thing or is there something particular in that episode which is really powerfully bad to you, which eclipses everything which was actually done reasonably well? And to be fair to Moffat episodes, were the ones where I had the most contention. Quite often, even the really bad ones, there would be some sharp lines in there. There would be some beautiful cinematography, or there would be something which would mean that you can't give it.
Have it in what? I mean, I hate the Doctor playing a guitar on a tank. In that opera.
Yes.
Without, you know, with a passion. But I also love Davros and the Doctor and the Sun coming up. So there's no way that's a 1 out of 10. You know, the Bells of St. John, I think, is really overblown pap. But you can't fault the heart and passion with which it's put together. Do I like it? No. Is it a 1 out of 10? Certainly not. I really am genuinely struggling to think of a 1 out of 10, you know, using my bench of I've wiped my bum on the script and posted it through your letterbox.
I think it's a particularly weird thing to do when you're doing it professionally as well. Where, I mean, I'm not saying from a career point of view, but it's just you are in a position where you're meant to have a certain degree of understanding of an industry.
Objectivity.
A certain amount of objectivity where you can say, I don't think this works well, but you should be aware that, you know, a show like that, if you give it 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10, I mean, the shots were beautiful. The effects, especially you think of Doctor Who's history, there wasn't one area of that story which looked wrong.
Soundtrack was gorgeous.
Soundtrack was great, yeah, absolutely. First time this season I noticed the soundtrack particular. Well, no, there's been a couple of times, but this time I really liked it.
It really built, especially in the last 10 minutes, I thought it was particularly fine. And some wonderful performances. You know, Bradley Walsh, you cannot say he's brilliant and then give it 1 out of 10. He alone, for those last few scenes with Grace, he's got to be worth 3 out of 10 on his own. Even if the rest of it was just them sat round drinking tea in the cafe at the end of The Apprentice, it's still worth 3 out of 10 for that moment.
And something else I really like about this season is it feels like we've gone back to sort of Cartmel a bit, or even earlier still, where we have TARDIS lands, get out, and they have an adventure without the TARDIS becoming intrinsically linked to them hopping around the place and...
Which is probably just as well, given the interior design.
Well, maybe. But it, I think that's nice.
That's a Sydney and Verity.
Yes, you know, it's a comfort, sir.
Sort of past, future, sideways. And I think we've just had our sideways one.
Well, listen, let's hit Facebook. Okay, some people will have to listen to these comments. May actually want to literally hit Facebook. Listen, when we say it here, did you enjoy the episode? Just tell us if you enjoyed the episode. If you didn't, say why you didn't. I feel like I'm getting a bit school teachery here, but really, I'm not interested in your "I didn't watch it," because that doesn't help me at all.
Consistent.
Yeah. Trevor Arthur, nice idea, but too slow for Sunday night, and a lot of the actors are too weak to keep it interesting. Debatable. Nick Griffiths, fears Doctor may have jumped the frog. Owen Lucas, liked it. A decent sci-fi story rather than Moistine moralising. It was a nice piece of escapism. Simon Disney, pretty decent, better than a lecture. There's a pattern developing here. Ruth Wheeler, oh my God, what was that? Did the writer use some of Vic Reeves' sketches? Let's not talk about Vic Reeves, because Gareth's going to bring something up if we do. I just can't believe how a story can get from mediocre to pure pap so quickly and still manage to tick a few more PC boxes on the way down. Didn't see that. Andy Kaminsky,
see about that? You know.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I didn't say anything. A clever idea. I love the fact that the actual footage was reflected and not that all the actors had to have their hair parted on the opposite side. Jodie Whittaker in the mirror looks so much like Rebecca Adlington, the Olympic swimmer. Maybe Rebecca Adlington looks like Jodie Whittaker looking into a spoon. I don't know.
Difference? Okay.
Jeff Waddle, best episode for years. Absolutely loved it. Philip Oakleford, interesting concept. However, what was the idea behind the father terrifying his blind daughter so that he could pop out for a few days? Appalling. I think we've addressed that. I think it's clear in the speech. It is appalling. It is uncomfortable. He's not a well man, is he?
Yeah.
It's grief. It's the selfishness of grief.
Yeah.
It's there's plenty of people who out there would probably be ashamed to admit it, but it's a thing that exists where some people are more in love with their partners than their kids.
Yeah. Rubber frog, a note back to the Shonky Monster. Was it rubber frog? I thought it was CGI.
It was a bloody rubber.
No, I don't think it was rubber. Probably the best performance Jodie Whittaker has given. Bradley Walsh continues to be the saving grace of this series. Rich Goldtree was quite enjoying it until the frog. Christine Gritt loved it. Katie Paul loved it, even the Shonky frog from the same stable as Bubble Wrap Monsters of old. I like the frog. Luke James really enjoyed it. And there's quite long comments from Luke and Katie and Christine. So head over to our Facebook page to check those out. We've got a lot of positive comments and a lot of people who didn't like it, but not saying why, blaming it on the frog. So
I am surprised. I thought there'd be more. That would have quite a united positive.
Yeah.
I could say, you know, I could see people were taking the piss out the frog or hating the frog before I watched it, because as I say, I have to watch it when I get home about 9.
Yeah, sure.
They are, of course, completely wrong, but I can see why some people would have a cultural cringe about the frog.
The old cultural cringe.
I think that's exactly what it is.
Mm.
You know, had it been, I don't know, a bloke in a spacesuit or some woman painted silver, that presumably would have been fine. Because it's a frog.
That's weird. I think one thing that's worth coming back to, because I noticed even The Guardian's run a story on it this morning, is the whole political correctness accusation.
Don't
get it.
Well, yeah.
I can see it, and I do see about there's that, nothing that. In this. There's not, doesn't seem to be anything in this episode.
Yeah, but one of the comments brought up, I mean, I just don't see what's PC about this. I just don't.
It's because it has a blind character in it.
Dramatically.
Well, if it's that, then the person concerned needs to have a good look in the mirror. It can't be that.
It's the only thing I can think of.
Fantastic dramatic conceit. You know, it's a wonderful dramatic conceit.
Yeah.
And it works. Oh.
I'm sure the logic is we didn't need a blind character in there, so therefore putting a blind character in there is to do with some sort of liberal agenda.
Bloody Norwegians coming over here, taking our acting jobs.
It frustrates me. You know, the whole thing, the political correctness, still frustrates me. You know, someone said to a friend of mine, you know, all this, you know, your generation's so politically correct, and they just turned around, and I think it was one of their famine, they just turned around and just kind of said, yeah, we just want to be better. And I kind of like that. Because, I mean, the only reason you could have an issue with them having a blind character in this and saying it's about some sort of agenda is sort of saying, well, you're ergo saying you can't have a blind person in this because we as a majority, we wouldn't tend to have one. So you think, well, how far do you go with that? How far before you take strip everything of difference, of colour, of drama, of understanding, of looking? And, you know, that's part of drama, is to actually see other cultures, other people, well, other points of view, and seeing how they, you know, they work with your own and learning something. And it just kind of...
We don't have any blind characters in Doctor Who anyway. You know, I can think of the wife in Battlefield,
mm-hmm.
who's basically... She basically serves the same purpose in the plot, in that she perceives danger differently, yeah. although she is cured of her blindness. It's actually one of my favourite scenes, the, you know, I will get the tab. I think it's one of those really strangely forgotten scenes. We've got Panna in Kinder, and she's just wise and blind. So what? No one goes, oh, politically correct, you know, wise old woman who's blind, you know.
But I wonder if the irony is that the reason it's politically correct is they've actually got someone who is blind to play the role, and thus... having to sort of, that becomes an agenda in itself, rather than having someone acting as blind, which surely is, in theory, it's worse because you're representing someone that you don't represent, which I suppose is what acting is, to be fair. But
yeah,
you know what I mean.
Acting is. I think we can avoid that really. My dad's half blind. He's been managing on one eye since 1981. I just want to say he has no special powers.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, okay, I suppose actually, to be fair, she had an intuition that at the end of this that the others didn't have. So I suppose you could say that plays into it a bit. But I found generally, because she was played as if she was blind without, generally speaking, any abnormal powers, that felt kind of fresh as well.
Mm.
I mean...
I mean, this is a series that we're going to be talking about in terms of this for a long, long time. And you know, rightly or wrongly,
but I'd still say back in the 70s, if there was the freedom of writing and there was the diversity of an awareness of a diversity of audience, that you weren't just transmitting largely to the man of the house and whoever was watching at the same time as him. They'd have been doing all this stuff back then. The writers would have been doing the same sort of things. It's a different era of
that. Well, I think there's a subtlety to it, isn't it? It's the subtlety that people object to, or the lack of subtlety. You know, in my opinion, the partition episode is 10 times better than the Rosa Parks episode. The Rosa Parks episode is there entirely to look good. It feels like that awful term virtue signaling, saying we're, you know, it's the Quantum Leap episode. We're going to do an episode about Rosa Parks. Aren't we wonderful? The actual episode that is, you know, if we're sticking on that kind of that area, that topic, the partition episode is far more important because it educates so many more people about something that's more important to Britain than Rosa Parks is.
It shows as consequence that people die.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Rosa Parks episode just feels like it feels cynical. I think that's the what I'm thinking. Yeah, that is what I feel. It feels cynical.
I think at the same time, Rosa Parks episode speaks to a lot of people who don't feel they get represented or their issues are acknowledged. I mean, I personally find the conversation behind the trash bin to me is a little on the nose. But then if I sort of dealt with racism every day, maybe that conversation would make me feel like, for God's sake, someone is, you know, I'm so glad that my favorite program is spelling this out. This is what I deal with every day. So I think it's a slightly different agenda. And I don't disagree with you. I think there's a far more, I think the partition episode has a far more, I don't know, there is an artistic and more intellectual, it's clever, it's far more, I don't know, yeah, I get what you mean, but I think both have a sort of place, and I don't think it's about agendas, I think it's about, like I've said before, it's about exploring stuff in this world which is so multicultural, so layered and so confusing. And so many people now, we acknowledge, watch Doctor Who and watch television, and so many people don't get represented. So many people, there is so much prejudice. I can kind of understand why the show is tackling these things, and each writer's doing it in different ways, I guess.
I think it's simpler than that. You know, I think that this is, you know, when I was back in school, you know, back in the 1800s, we didn't discuss Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks wasn't in any of the lessons.
Yes, that's true.
Really?
No, yeah, same here.
Oh, well, I did Rosa Parks.
History was sort of World War II, World War I, Industrial Revolution, and that was it, really.
No, I'm thinking, actually, Rosa Parks, I did do Rosa Parks, but it wasn't in history, it was in English language, and it was related to Kill Mockingbird.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
We just had lazy teachers that we just did, the staples of Mice and Men and Lord of the Flies.
Right.
So Rosa Parks wasn't it. Now, I think if you now fast forward and if you look at that core audience of people who are currently in school and people who are recently in school, I would be shocked if Rosa Parks isn't a big part of their curriculum, and they'll all, and the recognition of who Rosa Parks is will go up. You know, when I was 14, I don't think I knew who Rosa Parks was, to be quite honest.
Well, I think, and that's a fair, very good point, because Rosa Parks, for me, where I learned about Rosa Parks was science fiction. It was Quantum Leap, which, so in a sense, this could be someone's first introduction into Rosa Parks. Now, I still don't think that changes the fact that there is an argument, as Christian makes, that maybe there was a bit, it wasn't a very subtle episode. And there could be a counter argument that it's kind of good it isn't, because it makes the issues clear. I don't know. I still get that the Partition One certainly was, for me, a far more ingenious episode, a far more bold and
cutting episode. Well, I think the Rosa Parks one only became crap when she showed Rosa with Clinton and all that sort of stuff, and I didn't think it needed that.
Yeah.
That was where I think it did take that extra little smash you in the face and go... whereas it didn't need that. It didn't need that, and I thought that was... But I think all of those early episodes have had a little bit of a sort of tentative, still trying to grab hold of what their Doctor Who is going to be. And I think it isn't just Chibnall's Doctor Who. It's a writer's room. It's a team. It's a collegiate effort. And I think now they know what their Doctor Who is. And, you know, and maybe I've been hard on, maybe I've been hard on Jodie in that sense, saying that, you know, I haven't seen her full performance. you know, maybe her performance is based around compassion and a value for everyone. She doesn't need anger and outrage in her toolkit. That maybe she could do them, but they're choosing not to. Maybe I'm just looking at the maximum going, where's our Pyramids of Mars moment? And it doesn't need one.
I felt that, though, with Matt Smith's first season, where he did play a very unangry performance. There wasn't much where there was much, you know, fury that we were used to seeing with David Tennant or Eccleston. And that sort of came later on, where you got those moments. So maybe, again, it's not being built there. Or maybe like Davison, like you say, it's just not who that character is. And
it's not there, yeah. And that's okay.
Fair enough. Okay, well, next week's Doctor Who is giving us been giving lots of people some Dalek-y vibes. I wouldn't be surprised if there are no Daleks in it.
Same.
Yeah, I'm getting that sense now. I know I thought a week or two ago we were getting them, but perhaps we're not. And so that's okay.
There's been talk about the New Year's episode, isn't there? I don't know whether, again, that's just more speculation. Oh,
that could be a cheeky way around it. Because technically that's not part of this series.
Yeah.
Maybe. Next week is The Battle of Ranskor Av Kolos, which is one of those sci-fi titles, isn't it? It seems unnecessarily difficult to pronounce.
I'm all right with that.
And we're back to Chris Chibnall writing, so be interesting to see how we generally feel about the episode, given we've had 1, 2, 3, 4 episodes on the trot that weren't by Chris Chibnall, and it does feel as though this series has kind of got into its stride, I think.
There have been some good episodes, I must admit.
Yeah.
It has been a really good run.
But I'm kind of excited about not having any sort of series arc to lead to an ending, so I have no idea what the ending's going to be. I didn't watch the trailer or anything, so it's wonderful to be in the dark without any expectations brought by a series arc.
Nice, isn't it?
Absolutely. Okay, so gentlemen, ratings for the episode known as It Takes You Away. James?
I like this. I think this and the petition episode have been my favourites of the season. I think this was a little bit better so far, as I felt the end of the petition episode did drag a tiny bit at the time. So I'm going to give this 9.1 in case I gave 9 before.
Okay, Karen.
I have to agree with my colleague, the Right Honourable Member for Legopolis. I think this is my favourite. I've got to say it's a 9. It has brilliantly united fans of season 17 and fans of season 18 in a one-off ever to be repeated, has the best bits of everything. It's wonderful. And, you know, I've seen a lot of comments since saying it was very Douglas Adams-y, and I don't see that at all. I think it might have been a little bit Steven Spielberg-y, but not Douglas Adams. I think it was good and very enjoyable. And and we're not going to see that every week, and I'm happy. I think, this has been a good season for me.
Okay. I will agree with the Right Honourable Gentleman for Skonos. I'm giving it 9 out of 10. I would have given it 10 out of 10 if not for a combination of the info dump just felt a bit too heavy, and the Yorkshire accent.
It would have been nice to have actually seen if that episode hadn't done the info dump and given us sort of a very, very light suggestion of what was going on. I think that would have been, I know it would have made it less commercially viable, but I kind of liked to have had almost like a Twin Peaksian sort of Lynchian thing where we
couldn't be lightly sketched, couldn't it, and got away with it.
I think so. But I think it's the best episode in ages. I think it's the best episode since Heaven Sent.
I'd agree with that. It's the first one that I think I would rewatch and get a lot more out of it. One thing I didn't understand, but it doesn't matter because I enjoyed the performance, is what was Kevin Eldon doing there?
He was just populating the danger zone, wasn't he, really?
But for what?
Paycheck?
I don't know. I wasn't even... No. I don't know. But then I kind of like that. I sometimes think...
don't need it. Yeah, it's
television tells audiences everything because the audience is the master and the television is the jester. And I kind of like when television goes, no, it's just there. There could be a massive backstory and explanation while he's there, but we don't need it. So just move along. Move along.
You are quite right. We are looking for answers where there should be none.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that is It Takes You Away. The monster outside the house was just loudspeakers. The father was a bit mental, and it was all controlled by a frog. That's Doctor Who.
It is. really good.
Continue to let us know what you think, and we'll be back next week to discuss the final episode of Doctor Who, Series 11, Unpronounceable. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.